Welcome to Off the Shelf with Mary. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio or Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. I'm your host today, Dr. Mary Mitchell, and I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, metaphysics, and relationships today that might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. Today, we'll look at two books. The first is The Dance of Intimacy, A Woman's Guide to Courageous Acts of Change in Key Relationships. That was written by Dr. Harriet Lerner in 1989. The second book is To See Differently, Personal Growth and Being of Service Through Attitudinal Healing by Dr. Susan Trout. So, who is Dr. Harriet Lerner? She's an internationally acclaimed expert on the psychology of women and is a staff psychologist at the Menninger Clinic. She's also a lecturer, a consultant, and a workshop leader. Dr. Lerner describes intimacy this way. Intimacy means that we can be who we are in a relationship and allow the other person to do the same. It requires that we can talk openly about things that are important to us and that we take a clear position on where we stand on important emotional issues and that we clarify the limit of what is acceptable and tolerable to us in a relationship. And by allowing the other person to do the same means that we can stay emotionally connected to that other person who thinks, feels, and believes differently without needing to change, convince, or fix them. An intimate relationship is one in which neither party silences, sacrifices, or betrays the self, and each party expresses strength and vulnerability, weakness and competence in a balanced way. She examines turning points in the lives of women who courageously change their steps in relationship dances that were painful and going badly. In each case, these changes were made in the direction of defining a more whole and separate I, individual. And in each case, this work provided the foundation for a more intimate and gratifying we. Yet in no case was change easy or comfortable. The goal is to have relationships with both men and women that do not operate at the expense of ourself, and to have a self that does not operate at the expense of others. This is the heart and soul of intimacy. Just as we strive for change, we also strive to conserve what's most valuable and familiar in ourselves. You know, as women grow older and become more mature, and they want to have an intimate relationship, there may be a tendency to take half a loaf as better than none. We may compromise our standards more than we are later going to be comfortable with, and then we put our energy in trying to change the other person, which can be seen as energy-consuming as it is impossible. Pushing a partner to change is about as effective as trying to make friends with a squirrel as you're chasing it. A problem arises when we confuse intimacy with winning approval and when we look to intimate relationships as our sole source of self-esteem and when we enter relationships at the expense of ourself. Historically speaking, too often women have learned to sacrifice the I for the we. Lerner shares what happened in a women's group she led when they all agreed to say what they saw as the best of everyone and then the least of everyone. That would have been interesting. And what was interesting is what was labeled the best and the worst turned out to be the same. If the least liked trait with one woman's tendency to hog the spotlight, what they liked most about her was her energetic and entertaining personality. For another woman, the least liked trait was her failure to be straightforward and direct, but what they liked most was her kindness and respect for the feelings of others. In the end, it all showed how inseparable our strengths and weaknesses are. They're woven from the same strands in the fabric of our personalities. For Lerner, she discovered that she could be far more helpful to her clients when she was able to identify and appreciate both the positive aspects as what seem to be negative aspects of one personality. And then she shares a story about a family who did not appreciate how their one child's negative behavior served a positive function. The parents of a 7-year-old girl, let's call her Judy, was brought into therapy because she had temper tantrums and stomach aches and a variety of obnoxious misbehaviors. Her parents determined that Judy had to be fixed and asked Dr. Lerner to change her. After a lot of questioning, Dr. Lerner found out that Judy's problems began soon after the death of her grandfather, to whom she was quite attached. The family was not even talking about it. Judy's father became withdrawn and depressed with the loss of his father. He distanced himself from his wife and daughter, which left everyone quite anxious. And Judy's mother didn't openly address her concerns, instead focused totally on Judy's obnoxious behavior. Dr. Lerner found that Judy's negative actions reached a peak when her father's distancing and her mother's anxiety reached intolerable proportions. When Judy's troublemaking hit a peak, her father would get angry, but at least he paid more attention to the family and the parents would pull together temporarily. So subconsciously, Judy's behavior was in part an attempt to solve a family problem. Dr. Lerner shared how the parents increased focus on Judy and decreased focus on their own issues, maintained the very problem that they were trying to solve. You know, substantive change in important relationships rarely comes about through intense confrontation, but rather through careful thinking and planning for small, manageable shifts. It's based on understanding what the real problem is about. It's a slow dance, and we do it with ourselves and others, you know, moving back and forth between our want to change and our want not to change, between other people's desire for us to change and their anxiety when we do. So between our own wish for closeness when anxiety and isolation set in, and our need for distance when the togetherness just gets too suffering. When relationships often get stuck, they become very intense and very distant. Too much intensity means that one party is over-focused on the other in a blaming or worried way, or it's an attempt to fix or shape up the other person. Too much distance means that there's little togetherness and real sharing of one's true self in the relationship. Important issues get pushed underground rather than being aired and worked on. Once a relationship is stuck, the motivation to change things is often not sufficient to make it happen. When intensity is high, we react rather than observe and think. We overfocus on the other rather than on us, and we can find ourselves in polarized positions when we're unable to see that there's more than one side to the issue. We may have a strong desire for change, but we don't recognize the actual sources of the anxiety that are fueling this relationship problem. In essence, we're banging our heads in one area while ignoring the real problem. In a family under a lot of stress, we may see one person underfunctioning, another overfunctioning, and one may be distancing themselves, while another person overly focuses on something totally different. When the stress-created anxiety lasts long enough, the relationships get polarized, and it's hard to see a creative way out of the pattern. Lerner recommends that when a stalemate occurs, it's time to work on I, always in the direction of ourself, moving up the selfhood scale. This requires the parties to be totally honest with each other and share a balanced look at their strengths and vulnerabilities, to make clear statements of their beliefs, their values, their priorities, and then keep their behaviors congruent and stay emotionally connected to significant others, even when things get pretty intense. It requires addressing difficult and painful issues and taking a position on matters important to those involved, and stating our differences and allowing others to do the same. And now I think you can recognize how the assistance of a therapist can really help couples make it through this list. In the chapters that follow, Lerner shows how moving towards intimacy always requires us to focus on the self as the primary vehicle for change, while viewing the self in the broadest possible context, which is a difficult task in the best of circumstances. Lerner has a whole chapter on addressing anxiety. The initial impact of anxiety on a relationship is always one of increased reactivity, that automatic, anxiety-driven response. When we're in reactive gear, we're driven by our feelings, without the ability to think how we want to express them. In fact, we can't think about the self or our relationships with much objectivity at all. We want things to be calmer and more intimate, but we keep reflexively doing what we always do, which only leads to more of the same. It's important to practice and learn how to stand back a bit, tone down our reactivity, and do some problem solving. We can identify our individual coping style, observe how it interacts with the style of others, and modify our part in patterns that block intimacy. So often, one reactivity in one relationship is fueled by anxiety from an entirely different source. Next, Lerner explains how to create a plan to get out of the anxiety cycle. Because anxiety is something that comes up for you, these 15 pages are definitely worth a read. Throughout history, women have stood for connectedness and by working to maintain ties to past and future generations. Unfortunately, we've often done this at the expense of ourself, sacrificing personal and career goals central to both our self-esteem and our economic security. Men have had a complementary problem. They have tended to focus on moving up, measuring up, at the expense of connectedness to past and future generations. The success, if not the survival, of our intimate relationships rests on our being available and being able to get in balance. So too does the success and the survival of our world. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of super volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805, or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through careasy.org. And if you have any questions, give us a call, 1-855-500-7433. The next book is To See Differently, and it was written by Dr. Susan Trout. Who is Dr. Trout? When the book was published, she was the executive director of the Institute for Attitudinal Studies in Alexandria, Virginia. Today, the organization is located in Sausalito, California. In the 1990s, my husband and I took a two-day workshop based on this book at the original Center for Attitudinal Healing in Tiburon. This book was indispensable, and today it's still available through Amazon.com. Trout's purpose in writing the book was twofold. One was to guide those who wish to heal their attitudes about themselves, relationships, events, and situations. And two, for those who have a calling to serve others as a natural extension of that healing. It's very, very practical. What it offers can be immediately applied in daily life, in relationships with family and friends, and in work relationships, and in so many of life's circumstances. It's not about learning how to control or change outer events or people. It's about healing our mind and changing our perceptions. The book is divided into two parts. Part one discusses the philosophy of attitudinal healing, the nature of the healing process, the levels and attributes of being in service, along with a facilitator guide for use in support groups. Part two explains the 12 principles of attitudinal healing. The book can be used alone or with another person or in small groups. Two people can serve as buddies for one another and supporting each other's process. Journaling, along with reading and discussing the issues in the book, will assist you in observing the process and progress of your personal growth. In the introduction, Trout remembers in the early 1970s when she became aware of a dramatic philosophical shift that was occurring throughout the world, and especially in California, where she lived at the time. Social activism was giving way to individual change from the inside out. I remember it well. These new words popped up everywhere in the media: transformation, holistic health, the mind-body connection, spirituality, and personal growth. It was everywhere. There was a feeling of expectancy as people began to examine and take responsibility for their own emotional and spiritual well-being. The message was, there is another way to live in this world, and it includes techniques for this transformation, such as journaling, acupuncture, meditation, visualization, and attitudinal healing. Psychiatrist Jerry Jampolsky derived the principles of attitudinal healing from the popular book A Course in Miracles. Attitudinal healing became one way to express what the Course taught. The only necessity was being willing to see differently and to look within for the peace that would bring sense to emotional and spiritual well-being. Attitudinal healing is a process of healing the mind so that we can experience inner peace. It means choosing a perception of the world that mirrors the inner state we want to create. At that time, few people understood how their mind worked or how to keep it healthy. Trout recognized that as we were taught to read and write, to open a checking account and drive a car, we were not taught how to handle conflicts, how to lovingly relate to others, and how to feel safe in a seemingly unsafe world. While Trout was working at a university department for behavior problems in children and adults, one day her former husband dropped by. This was the husband against whom she had held absolutely justifiable and unforgivable grievance. He handed her a black binder, and on the pages inside were written the words as forgiveness, guiltlessness, inner peace. He told her it came from The Course in Miracles and thought maybe it would help her. Well, Susan took the binder home and put it on the floor in the darkest corner of a closet in a room she rarely used. But weeks later, for some reason, she got the binder out and saw the words, "How willing are you to forgive your brother? How much do you desire peace instead of endless strife, misery, and pain? Forgiveness is your peace." The book specifically addressed the issue of resentment and promised a way to be healed of emotional pain. She began to read, and it wasn't long before she committed to her own healing. She read books and took training and workshops in dream psychology, meditation, mysticism, synthesis, journaling, and metaphysics, and even attended a holistic health conference. And it wasn't long before she noticed an improvement in the quality and creativity of her professional work. She saw a direct correlation between the changes in her inner life and what was reflected in her outer life. And for the first time, she saw the possibility of experiencing peace of mind while living on this earth. She realized that there's a core truth that underlies all great teachings, whether we acknowledge it or not. And it's this core, in the form of basic assumptions about the structure of the universe and our relationship to it. I like her description. Attitudinal healing became the sieve through which she strained new information. There are five states in the process of healing our attitude. Stage one, we question our attitude. Perhaps we have a sense that life has no meaning. Am I kind of drifting aimlessly around? Are most things irrelevant to me? Is my life at a standstill? The resolution of such a crisis begins when, out of curiosity, we explore the meaning of our existence beyond what our personality defines it to be. And it naturally begins to feed an increasing flow of energy from our higher self. We investigate spiritual philosophies, metaphysics, modern physics, to see if there are any other ways to look at the world. And actually, other ways do matter. In stage two, we explore choices. It's one thing to question our view of ourself and the world, but it's quite another to truly make a commitment to actively explore the unknown and how it might change our life. It can be a time of great fear, a fear of loss of everything that we believed in. Can we be open to the possibility that what we thought was true, or maybe not? This is a time to cultivate patience. Stage three invites us to make a full commitment to our healing. Once we make a commitment, the universe begins to support our decision and synchronistic events occur. We feel increasingly empowered as we acknowledge the inner strength and resources we forgot we already had that we can contribute to the process. In stage four, we allow old patterns to dissolve, such as looking at those times when our needs were not being met. And we develop strategies for dealing with our pain. The pain energy from those events is trapped in our body. And as we willingly release it, tears begin to flow. Another way to look at this is when we've held on to undelivered communications we held inside of ourselves out of fear, we find a way to bring it to the surface. We can journal about it. We can forgive ourselves and release it. Other energies we might have buried include anger, guilt, and fear. It's time to get honest with ourselves and release those energies that do not contribute to our healing. A powerful contribution to healing our attitude is called the witness self, where we observe what's happening and yet don't identify with our thoughts, emotions, desires, or sensations. Ram Dass put it this way in his book, How Can I Help? Imagine that our mind is like the blue sky and thoughts pass by as clouds. We can get a feel for the part of it which is not our thoughts. The sky is always present, and it contains clouds, and yet it's not contained in them. And so it is with our awareness that's present and encompasses our thoughts, feelings, and sensations, but it is not them. To recognize and acknowledge this awareness with its spacious, peaceful quality is very useful. We need not identify with each thought just because it happens. We can remain quiet and choose which thought to attend to. We can remain aware behind all these thoughts in a state that offers an entirely new level of openness and insight. In stage five, we acknowledge our growth, our efforts, and we welcome how it feels to be nurtured. Being of service to others is a natural result of attitudinal healing. It becomes a natural extension of our love of ourself, because service is love in action. It is love deliberately and creatively applied and circulated. We love or serve other people by eliciting their resources, by understanding, by sharing a vision, healing an emotional wound, or through education or other ways, at all levels from the physical to the spiritual. There are 12 principles taught in attitudinal healing. The first is the power of love. Love is a permanent state in each human being, but is often shaded by self-doubt, jealousy, confusion, anger, resentment, which are all forms of fear. And when we begin to bring love to the forefront of our mind by consciously looking for evidence of the love wherever we can, whether it's through music, nature, animals, or another person, journaling on where we are in life when we have felt love or given love, brings it to our conscious mind, and it feels pleasurable. Another way is to meditate on what we love. You know, there are a lot of exercises in this book to help with this, pages of them. So in time, we notice most of the love essence around us has a sense of peacefulness. When we can catch ourselves being negative, it's easier to offer a positive and loving thought, and that love will be reflected back to us. Principle two is health. Health is inner peace, and healing is letting go of fear. The goal of health is inner peace, a state of mind that is harmonious, flexible, alive, and energized. Principle three is giving and receiving are the same. You know, it's true. Giving is essential to our well-being, and we must be willing to value ourselves and others enough to receive the kind of loving thoughts extended to us. Principle four states that we can let go of the past and of the future. And when we do this, we're more open to the gift of the present moment. Anytime we find ourselves reacting instead of acting, we're bringing our past perceptions into the present. It's important to be accountable, for this is the first step in healing our perceptions, being in the present moment. Recognize that the present moment is continuously becoming the future. So to create a peaceful future, we create a peaceful presence. And that allows us to be more emotionally available for whatever happens. Principle five states that now is the only time there is, and each instant is forgiving. To live life fully is to live every moment to its fullest. Principle six is that we can learn to love ourselves and others by forgiving rather than judging. Amen. Forgiveness is being able to hold ourselves and others in our heart, regardless of what has happened. It's the willingness to perceive ourselves and others as either expressing love or giving a call for love. It reduces stress and positively affects our physical health. When judgment is any belief, thought, or evaluation or condemnation, it results in separation and isolation. Therefore, forgiveness truly is grace. It's a gift we give ourselves. Principle seven is that we can become love finders rather than fault finders. To love find is to see beyond the personality to the essence of ourselves and others. To fault find is to see the personality only. To love find is to see the value and learning opportunity in every moment. And to fault find is to see oneself and others as a victim of circumstances. So, you know, both love finding and fault finding can crystallize into a habit and become a way of life. Just in case you've ever met somebody who has fault finding constantly on their mind. Principle eight is that we can choose and direct ourselves to be peaceful inside, regardless of what's happening outside. It requires that our primary goal on earth is to have peace of mind. And it's how we extend peace in the world. Inner peace comes from knowing that we have the power to choose our attitude in any circumstance. We can bring peace to any situation when we bring our peaceful mind. Principle 10 asks us to focus on the whole of life rather than the fragments, to take a big, godlike spiritual perspective of everything that's going on. Principle 11 says, love is eternal. Death need not be viewed as fearful. And principle 12, we can always perceive ourselves as either extending love or giving a call for help for love. So if you're interested in attitudinal healing, check out their website is ahinternational.org. It initially started in Tiburon, California, but now it's in Sausalito, California. You know, I hope you've enjoyed hearing about A Woman's Guide to Courageous Acts in Relationship and Principles of Attitudinal Healing. Wrapping up beautifully, as always, we're going to play some beautiful music for you. Wow.